There are a lot of questions we get asked in life, and some of those are more important than others. You know, what do you want to be when you grow up? Where do you want to live? What kind of education are you going to pursue? What are your likes and dislikes? Are you still loyal to the 49ers? Do you have enough toilet paper for the coronavirus quarantine? Well, today we're going to be talking about an extremely important question. And so if you would, let's be turning to Mark chapter 8. We're going to be looking at this passage in the dead center of the Gospel of Mark. And many people think Mark put it there for a reason, but whatever reasons he may have had, what is said there is definitely to be at the center of our Christian faith. Well, Jesus is getting toward the end of his earthly ministry, but most people, they still didn't understand who he really was. And even the 12 apostles who had been with him through all of that, well, no, they didn't fully understand. For example, earlier in chapter 8, they were heading across the Sea of Galilee in a boat. And Jesus, he wanted to take that opportunity to teach them something. And so he said, "Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod." Well, the apostles, they started looking at each other. What in the world? He's, you know, wondering what he's talking about. Leaven, yeast, bread. Oh, he must be talking about the fact that we have no bread. Who brought lunch? That's what I want to know. And Jesus is listening to that, and he said, "Do you not remember when I fed the 5,000? Oh, yeah, Lord, that was amazing. And how many basketfuls of leftovers did you pick up? 12. Amazing. There were 12. And do you not remember when I fed the 4,000? Oh, yes, Lord. In fact, that just happened. That was something else. And how many basketfuls of leftovers did you pick up? 7 basketfuls of leftovers. We should have brought some of those leftovers with us. Who forgot to take some of the leftovers?" Well, Jesus, he asked, "Do you not yet understand?" Verse 21. You see, they didn't really know who was in the boat with them, or they wouldn't have been arguing about bread. You don't have to worry about bread when you've got Jesus around. He was talking about something much more important. Anyway, that brings us to our passage. It was time for the apostles to come to grips with who he really is. So number one, the different views, verses 27 through 33. So let's read this. Jesus went out along with the disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he questioned his disciples, saying to them, "Who do people say that I am?" They told him, saying, "John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, but others one of the prophets." And he continued by questioning them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered and said to him, "You are the Christ." And he warned them to tell no one about him. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. And he was stating the matter plainly. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning around and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan. For you are not setting your mind on God's interests, but man's." Now, Jesus is not asking for information. Okay? He already knew what the people were saying. I think that he wanted to get all the erroneous ideas, all those views out on the table. And this is actually a really good teaching tool. Because when we get all the wrong answers out in the open, the truth can often shine through. Well, Jesus is obviously a hot topic of conversation. There's a lot of rumors, a lot of confusion going around. And you remember John the Baptist, his role was to get the people ready for Jesus. And we read about his execution in chapter 6 by Herod Antipas. And that was actually Herod's idea of Jesus. Elijah, of course, he was a great prophet, lived about 900 years before this time, and who had miraculous power. And Malachi chapter 4 told them to look for his return, which was actually referring to John the Baptist. Well, when we read Matthew's account, Matthew tells us that they also added Jeremiah. Now, he was a prophet who lived about 600 years before this time, And he wrote the books of Jeremiah and Lamentations. But the interesting thing is, these are all of these answers are of dead messengers of God. I guess they thought that would explain his miraculous powers. He was a prophet who was reincarnated or resurrected from the dead or something like that. What we find is that there is still an amazing amount of confusion today. I mean, you do an internet sometime on Jesus and see what you find. Jesus is the most controversial person who has ever lived. You want to create a commotion? You just bring up the subject of Jesus in a diverse group of people, especially if you're in my home state of California. You will find that your grandmother's got one idea, and your cousin's got another idea, and your neighbor's got yet another idea, and your coworker still another, and on. See, from first century Palestine to 21st century America, people have always had their own take on Jesus. There have been plenty of different theories about him, both ancient and recent. I mean, history is full of reinventions and reinterpretations of Jesus. I'm sure you've noticed in the last few decades, we've had all of these books and blockbuster movies and documentaries dedicated to radical new ideas about him. As it's been said, we are receiving updates on Jesus as often as we get updates for our computer. Well, he continued by questioning them, "But who do you say that I am?" These questions, who do people say that I am and who do you say that I am, they are relevant for every age. Because the way that we answer them will greatly affect our lives. You see, the way you view Jesus will determine how you respond to him. It will determine what you do with him. Well, Peter, with his personality, is often the first one to speak. "You are the Christ." You know, Christ, that's not his last name. It's the Greek word for Messiah, literally the anointed one. And so to call Jesus Christ is to make the theological claim that he is the Messiah prophesied about that the Old Testament scriptures pointed to. But Jesus warned them here not to tell anyone that. Why not? Well, it obviously wasn't the right time, and I suspect it had something to do with the fact that most of the Jews had the wrong idea about the Messiah. They thought the Messiah was going to be this political and military hero who would, you know, throw off the bonds of the Romans and restore them to the glory days of King David. And at this point, the disciples themselves, they had just too many incorrect ideas in their heads to properly teach about him being the Messiah. Okay, the time's going to come when they're going to tell everyone, but not yet. At this point, it's just going to arouse the false hopes of those who are looking for an earthly Christ. Now, take a look at verse 31. The religious leaders, well, they didn't see Jesus as a return prophet. They sure didn't see him as a Messiah. They saw him as a troublemaker and a threat, someone who was leading the people astray, that is, from them. Again, the way you view Jesus determines how you respond to him. Now, some people ask about that term, Son of Man. It was a messianic term, and it was the most popular designation that Jesus used for himself. And it apparently refers to his humanity. Just a son of God, that refers to his deity. Now, notice how he's talking about human suffering. But it also seems to point to the prophecy in Daniel 7 about the Son of Man going before the Ancient of Days and receiving an eternal kingdom. But the point is, this is what was really connected to being the Messiah, the suffering servant of Isaiah 53. By his wounds, we are healed. And keep in mind, as we look at this, that Jesus did not want to go to the cross, as we can see later from the Garden of Gethsemane. Well, Peter took him aside and started to rebuke him. So what's wrong with this picture? Rebuking the Messiah and the Son of God. He would not have done that if he truly understood who Jesus is. What Jesus said didn't fit Peter's view of the Messiah. He couldn't imagine a rejected and dying Messiah. But the Messiah wasn't there to achieve this earthly glory and triumph that he's thinking. No, no, he was there to achieve spiritual glory and triumph. And so Peter, he had the right words, verse 29, but the wrong view. And he apparently missed the rise again part. People can easily have the right answer to who Jesus is and still have some incorrect or some imbalanced view of Jesus. And we all need to be careful that doesn't apply to us. Look at verse 33. The other apostles, they were apparently listening, and they needed to hear this. So what did Jesus mean by "get behind me"? Well, it could be referring to leaving his sight. You remember after the temptations in Matthew chapter 4 that Jesus said, "Be gone, Satan." Or it could have something to do with lining up behind him. We need to follow Jesus and not try to tell him what to do. We always need to make sure that we don't fall into the setting our minds on man's interests and not God's. Satan can definitely use man's logic and emotions. Peter had allowed himself to be a tool in the hands of Jesus, or in the hands of Satan, not Jesus. I'm convinced that Satan will try to use those closest to us, our friends and our family, to try to discourage us, to try to keep us from doing great things for God, and many times without them knowing it. "Oh, I know you. You can't quit that. Don't be silly. You'll never be able to achieve that. You can't fool me. I knew you when you were in diapers. It won't hurt if you just miss a few Sundays. Oh, come on. God won't mind if you..." Whatever. Barclay put it like this: "It is a strange thing, and sometimes a terrible thing, that the tempter sometimes speaks to us in the voice of a well-meaning friend. We may have decided on a course which is the right course, but which will inevitably bring trouble, loss, unpopularity, sacrifice. And some well-meaning friend tries with the best intentions in the world to stop us. The tempter can make no more terrible attack than in the voice of those who love us and who think they seek only our good. That is what happened to Jesus that day. That is why he answered so sternly." And so, anyway, looking back, we might categorize these as three incorrect views of Jesus. There was the perspective of the multitudes, this superstitious idea about Jesus being a return prophet. And of course, many of them were simply interested in what he could do for them. They were interested in the bennies, the benefits, him healing them and feeding them. Then there was the perspective of Peter, and I suspect the other apostles as well. A view that he was the Messiah, but apparently along the lines of the popular notion that the Messiah would be a military leader who would ride in on a white horse and rally the troops, you know, against their enemies. And finally, there was the perspective of the religious leaders, a view that Jesus was neither a returned prophet nor the Messiah, but rather a nuisance and a troublemaker that they had to deal with. Well, all three of those were wrong. Again, the way you view Jesus determines how you respond to him. Is he a liar, lunatic, or legend, as the skeptics would assert? Well, if so, then he can be safely ignored. Is he an alien, as the UFO enthusiasts would claim? Well, if so, then you might dedicate a blog to that idea. Is he just another good teacher? Well, if so, then we may enjoy listening to him, but that's as far as it goes. I mean, he doesn't carry any authority. But if we truly see him as the Messiah and as the Son of God, and if we truly want to be one of his disciples, then how should we respond? That question is answered in the next section. So number two, the cost of discipleship, verses 34 through 38. Let's continue reading. And he summoned the crowd with his disciples and said to them, "If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what will a man give in exchange for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will also be ashamed of him when he comes in the glory of his Father with his holy angels." To follow Jesus is referring to being one of his disciples. The word disciple, it carries with it the idea of a student and a follower. And obviously, not everyone who calls himself or herself a disciple is actually that is entitled to that designation and considered that by Jesus. We can see that there are three steps here in verse 34. And some people like to picture it like this. There are three things necessary in traveling. First, to say farewell to self. Second, to carry our luggage, the cross. And third, to proceed with the journey, follow me. Okay, the first step is to deny self. Now, I don't think that means to deny yourself things like in asceticism. Now, you don't have to become a monk in a monastery. Well, other people look at this and they think that it means, well, if I want to become a Christian, I got to deny myself things like cussing, getting drunk, and chasing after women. And while that's true, I think it's much broader than that. I believe it carries the sense of what Peter would do three times in chapter 14 concerning Jesus. Disown him. It's the same word in the Greek. I think this is talking about disowning the old you before you became a Christian. In other words, see, we're looking at our old self and we're saying, I don't want to be that guy anymore. I'm done with my old way of life. Well, the second step is to take up your cross. And that doesn't mean to carry it around your neck, although there's probably nothing wrong with doing so. Let's think about it. What did it mean in that culture to take up your cross? It meant you were going to die. They would have them carry their cross to the place of execution. It was an instrument of death, like the electric chair, hangman's noose, or the gas chamber. Now, we often use that term, my cross to bear, to speak of suffering or some kind of difficulty. Every now and then you'll find a woman who introduces her husband as her cross to bear. But it originally meant death. In Galatians 2:20, the Apostle Paul said, "I have been crucified with Christ, and it is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and delivered himself up for me." And so Paul died by joining Jesus on the cross, Christ physically and Paul spiritually. Now he lives not as he wants to, but as Jesus would. You might say it's Paul on the cross and Jesus in Paul's body. Paul moves out and Christ moves in. First, we have to deny our old self. There's the desire for a change. And then we've got to crucify it. Galatians 5:24, it says, "Those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires." The problem is the old you keeps wanting to come back. It keeps wanting to resurrect itself. And so how often does this have to be done? According to Luke 9:23, daily. Every day, we are to put our old self up on the cross and let Jesus control our new self. And whenever our old self tries to dictate what we should do, we need to tell it to get back up on the cross. Orbison made this comment, "I wish I could say that the first time you put self on the cross, that it died once and for all. But sadly, that is not the case. Self has the uncanny ability to resurrect itself and return to attempt to run our new life in Christ. From time to time, it raises its ugly head and wants to resume where we left off in our sinful pursuits. So Christ says that you must continually take the cross with you so that you may again crucify self when it comes back. And then the third step is to follow him. We are not ready to follow him until we've done the first two. Why? Well, the reason that we have to first deny self and take up our cross is because Jesus will lead us to say and to do things that our old self would not want to say and to do. For example, right, Jesus declared that families would be divided over loyalty to him, and that one must be willing to sacrifice everything if necessary. He laid down a rigorous teaching enforcing the stability of marriage. He taught that we are to love our enemies and pray for those who persecute us. He taught that we are not to do things for the praise of men. He taught that the first would be last, and those who want to be great must become a servant. He promised that his followers would receive persecution. You see, a Christian may literally have to take up a cross, and so forth. And those are things the old worldly you would never do. And so it is only when we have silenced our old way of thinking and our old way of doing things that we are ready to listen to a new voice that's giving us directions. We're no longer listening to self, but to Christ. So why would we do that? I mean, why would we follow him? Because he is the only one who knows the way to the Father's house, John 14, verses 1 through 6. And he can guide us home to God. Look, there are a lot of people who claim to be guides. And oh, they tell us emphatically that we should follow them. But Jesus is the only one who can lead us where we really need to be. I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. Jesus then made an interesting statement here in verse 35. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. So what does that mean? Well, some people think this is talking about someone who wishes to save his old sinful life from the previous verse. And others think that he's talking about martyrdom. You see, Jesus was going to die, verse 31. Many of his followers would as well. Of the 12, apparently, all but John did. How connected are you to this earthly existence? You know, in many cultures, your Christianity, even today, could get you killed. And you notice how he added the Gospels. You know, some missionaries have been killed trying to bring the Gospels to lost people. If we have crucified self, then it's going to be a lot easier to do this if necessary. See, there are too many Christians today who act like this life is the end-all, be-all. And so they're trying to hang on to this life for dear life. Persecution must be accepted as a price to pay for following Jesus. A genuine disciple will love him more than life itself, as this expression goes. He then asked a couple of rhetorical questions about gaining the whole world. Now, you notice how he's using accounting language with profit and loss. Now, I think his point is that it's worth it, referring to what he said in verses 34 and 35. Linsky made this observation. Jesus supposed the absolute limit that a man may secure for himself the whole world, all the world's wealth, power, pleasure, glory, the beauty of all the fair things that ever graced the world, the sweetness of all the delicacies that ever grew in it, the grandness of all the high things that ever towered aloft in it, all sensations, all enjoyments, all achievements, all satisfactions. Of course, such a thing is frankly impossible for any human being, and that is understood. But granting the impossible, and for the moment accepting it as real, in what is this man benefited? Would you think the person wise who outdid Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Carlos Slim, and all those guys, and yet went to hell. Eternity is a lot longer than your life on this cursed earth. And yeah, there's some nice things, but it's also filled with the coronavirus, with taxes, and with toilet paper shortage. Anyway, it's a bad investment. And most people, they forfeit their soul for just a small piece of this world. Well, Satan doesn't even have to offer them very much. I've known people whose businesses started taking off and making some good money. And so I noticed they started coming to church less and less until they eventually quit coming altogether. And the second question, that's just another way to look at it. So if man's already forfeited his soul, all right, what can he possibly give as an exchange of equal value to get it back? You know, some of our kids may be wondering if their Pokemon cards would be enough. Not even close. Look, there's only one way to make sure that your soul is safe for eternity. And that's by becoming a disciple and following the directions that Jesus gave in this section. Verse 38. For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will also be ashamed of him when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. Just let that verse sink in. That's quite a statement. Have you ever been in the past? And notice that it's not just of him, but also of his words. There are a lot of controversial and politically incorrect sayings and statements of Jesus. And ours could certainly be described as an adulterous and sinful generation, unfaithful to God in so many ways. And there are many venues where Christians are in the minority. And they are intimidated into feeling shame because of their relationship with Christ. Peer pressure, it affects everyone. No one likes being made fun of. No one likes being looked down on. No one likes being negatively singled out in a crowd. And when you're being mocked and you're being told that your beliefs are crazy, or they're just too extreme, or at least they're out of touch with reality, it's really easy to feel the same pressure that Peter felt in the courtyard of the high priest. And that was when he denied Jesus those three times. But if you really think about it, you know, the sinful world, it's not pleasing to God. It's pleasing to Satan. The sinful world is not in charge of our eternal destiny. God is. And on top of that, the sinful world is constantly changing its mind as to what's proper and to what is in vogue. It is not a good standard. And so why would we feel compelled to appease it? The question is not, what do my peers think about this, but what does God think about it? It's a great test. Thankfully, if we mess up, we can follow the example of Peter and repent and do better in the future. Now, depending on the time and the place, the other kids in school, they may call you a chicken, pansy, scaredy cat, yellow, or lily-livered. That one's really old. But you know who the real chicken is? The real chicken is the one who goes along with the crowd when he or she knows that it's not the right thing to do. It's the one who is ashamed of his Lord and compromises his faith out of fear. And so to exchange eternity for the world, that's not a good bargain. And to exchange eternity for an adulterous and sinful generation, well, that's not a good bargain either. There's a saying, don't sacrifice eternity for the moment. A few fleeting moments of pleasure or of popularity, it's not worth it. And so here are some test questions for each of us to answer. Number one, do I deny my old self and take up my cross daily? Not just when it's convenient. Number two, would I be willing to die for Jesus if necessary? See, what if that's the direction that our country ends up taking? Number three, if Satan offered me the whole world for my soul, I could own it all, would I take the deal? What Jeff Bezos makes, that's just peanuts next to the whole world. Number four, Do I find myself in circumstances where I'm too ashamed to make known that I am a disciple, that I am a Christian? Discipleship is more than being baptized and occupying a pew on Sunday. It will cost you something. In fact, it will cost you everything. It is a lifestyle, and it is a genuine commitment to following Christ, the one who paid an enormous price for us, verse 31. We must say no to our sinful desires. We must say no to our old way of living. But again, the world's not going to like that, will they? See, our teachings and our lifestyle, it makes them uncomfortable. And no one likes being told, no one likes being shown that what they're doing is wrong. And because of that, we can expect what Peter said in 1 Peter 4. They're surprised that you do not run with them into the same excess of dissipation, and they malign you. But it's more than worth it. And so let's never deny Jesus. Let's deny self and take up our cross and follow him. That is the response of somebody who truly understands the identity of Jesus. And that is what it means to be a genuine disciple of Christ. I want to leave you with an illustration that I've heard before. Man woke up in the morning and he went into the bathroom to get ready for work. And he looked in the mirror and he saw the image of Christ. See, this man was a Christian, and so he was trying to reflect that image in his life. Well, he got ready, and he went out, and this morning he made his own breakfast. And he did that because he wanted his wife to sleep. She had stayed up late that night before with one of their sick children. So he got ready, and he was heading out the door, and he saw, leaning against the wall, an old rugged cross. So he picked up that cross, he threw it over his shoulder, and he went out and got in his car. He's driving to work, and the traffic is really bad this morning, but he's singing hymns. He's happy, he's not going to let that get him down. But he sees over on the side of the road, there's a car, and its hood is up, and there's a man who's clearly dressed for work, and he's got three little kids with him. They obviously need help, but no one is stopping to help them. And the man looks at his watch and he says, if I pull over to help them out, I'm going to be late for work and my boss is going to chew me out again. But then he hears the voice of Jesus. It is time for you to die. And so he climbs on that cross and he crucifies self and he pulls over. He finds out that the man is going to be late for a presentation, a very important one, and the three kids are going to be late for school. And so he says, you know what? I got a buddy who owns an auto repair shop, and he's even got a tow truck. Let me give him a call. I'll call him. He will come and get your car. You guys jump in with me. And so he drops the kids off at their school. He drops the man off at his work, and he finally gets to his work, and sure enough, he's late. And sure enough, the boss tells him out. Well, just reads him the riot act. But he's smiling on the inside. He feels good because he knows that he did what Jesus wanted him to do. Well, lunchtime came, and some of the fellows, some of the guys, they asked him to go sit with them. But the thing is, he knew they're going to do what they always do, and that's tell all of the latest dirty jokes. And he really wanted to go over there with them. But then he heard the voice of Jesus say, it's time for you to die. And so he went over and he sat by himself and he opened his Bible and he read the scriptures while he was eating his lunch. Well, the end of the day came and it was time to leave. And some of his fellow workers, they said, hey, we're going over to the bar after work. Why don't you come over and come over with us, you know, like you used to? We've been missing you. And he remembered how much fun it was to do that in the past. But then he heard the voice of Jesus say, it is time for you to die. And so he crucified self, and he let the voice of Jesus win out over his own voice, and he went home to his family. Well, Sunday rolled around, and man, he was tired. He had worked an extra shift for a guy whose mother had died, and so he had worked an extra shift on Saturday. And so he thought, well, I'll just help the wife get the children ready for Bible class, and then I'll head back to bed. And then he heard the voice of Jesus say, it is time for you to die. And so he crucified self, and he listened to the will of Jesus. Well, years went by, and it wasn't easy. You know, some days were harder than others. He certainly wasn't perfect, but he continued to take that cross with him, even though he was made fun of by his old friends. What he discovered, though, was that the more he did it and the longer he did it, the easier it became. Well, he retired, he got old, and he died. He then stood before the judgment seat of Christ. Do you know what he heard him say? Well done, good and faithful servant. And he continued by questioning them, but who do you say that I am?